Good morning and welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble sitting in for Ann today. This hour is about cybersecurity, but first, the big story of the day is that Columbus was not selected for the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Democrats chose Philadelphia as the site. Brooklyn, New York was the third finalist. The DNC chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz was in Columbus back in January 23rd, for the final visit, which focused on logistics. Columbus pushed the city's close proximity to the convention center and nationwide arena, as well as all the major hotels downtown. But ultimately, Philadelphia was chosen. In an email today, Wasserman Schultz said, in addition to Philadelphia's commitment to a seamless and safe convention, the city's deep-rooted place in American history provides a perfect setting for this special gathering. Philly has hosted party conventions 8 times. The convention in 2016 will be held the week of July 25th. Target, Home Depot, Chase Bank, and Anthem Health Insurance. What do all of these names have in common? Well, they were all victims of cyber hacks that left the personal data of millions vulnerable. Last month, President Obama discussed cybersecurity in the lead up to his State of the Union address.
We're proposing new cybersecurity legislation to promote the greater information sharing we need between government and the private sector. This builds and improves upon the legislation that we've put forward in the past.
On Tuesday, the president announced the creation of a new agency called the Cyber Threat Intelligence Integration Center. Joining us now by phone to discuss President Obama's cybersecurity agenda is reporter for Politico Pro, Joseph Marks. Welcome to the show, Joseph.
Thanks for having me, Mandy.
Great. What do we know so far about this new agency and how it will work?
We know a lot about what it won't do. We know a little bit less about what it will do. It's going to be about a $35 million agency with about 50 employees, some of them temporary, some of them permanent staff within government. And it's largely going to be modeled on the National Counterterrorism Center, which means, as far as we can tell, a pretty narrow mandate. It's going to take the information, the intelligence that's gathered throughout government about cybersecurity. It's going to integrate it. It's going to try to connect the dots that aren't being connected now. It's going to give that back out to the government and, in some cases, not directly but through other agencies, to the private sector so they can be more aware of cyber threats.
You wrote recently that some lawmakers claim they were not briefed on this new center. Is that the case?
As far as we can tell, it is. The Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee say that they were given some information. This is staff members, I should say, say that they were given some information about the center the night before. Republican members say if that happened, you know, we weren't in the loop on it. That's not totally abnormal, but it also doesn't bode very well for this being a sort of joint executive legislative mandate. If they ever want to get, say, legislation that will specifically authorize this past the current administration, you know, that this isn't a good start for bipartisanship on the issue.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is what effect will it have on that?
Yeah, bipartisanship is, you know, obviously in pretty short supply in Washington. Cybersecurity has often been a place where it does exist by and large. The previous chairman and ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, and Dutch Ruppersberger were sort of famously known as working together very closely. We haven't really gotten a sense yet of whether their successors are going to be that close on the issue. There's general agreement that Congress wants to do something about cybersecurity. It's not really a right-left issue. But, you know, a lot of the trouble is getting enough air in the room to actually get something done. The information sharing legislation that the president described in the clip that you played, you know, has been up for, was pretty close last Congress, didn't make it. It's been, you know, on the books for a long time. No one's really been able to get across the finish line before.
There have been some concerns raised that the center may duplicate services of existing federal cyber centers. What can you tell us about that?
When the center was first announced earlier this week, there wasn't a whole lot of information about it. And there are other centers, most notably the NCIC, and the National Cybersecurity Incident Something Center. I'll butcher the acronym if I actually try to say it, that are tasked with taking cyber threat information and sharing with the private sector. So the big concern I guess there were two concerns. One is when this was first announced, we don't want this to duplicate what the NCIC is already doing, some of the stuff that U.S. CERT, that's sort of the cybersecurity response team, are doing on the one hand. On the other hand, if it isn't doing something to improve threat sharing, information sharing with the private sector, you know, how it's not really getting at the center of the problem. You know, with terrorism, that's, which is this, you know, modeled on the NCTC, that's pretty much an in-government problem. There are different agencies that have information about terrorism, from, you know, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, et cetera. They're not talking to each other. Here's a center that can make them talk to each other, to connect the dots, that can make this sort of a whole-of-government response. With cybersecurity, about 80% of networks are owned by the private sector. Often the private sector has more information than the government does about some threats. So getting information shared better between the private sector and the government is really the biggest problem. There are ways in which the administration is saying that this center will help that sort of on the back end, but it doesn't really address what most people say is the biggest problem.
Yeah, the president is scheduled to speak more about that that topic in California this week. You have mentioned the private sector a couple of times. Is the government working at all with the private sector, particularly in Silicon Valley, where there's been talk about threats in that area?
Well, the NCIC center that has been set up does bring in the private sector. They do. There are these things called ISACs, Information Sharing and Analysis Centers, that are set up industry by industry that share information with the Homeland Security Department in a sort of formalized way. So this is happening. The bigger problem is that there hasn't been a sort of a legislative framework to make this easier. There was a bill called CISPA in the House and CISA in the Senate last Congress, the one that the president talked about, that would essentially lower the barriers for industry to share information with each other and with the government. Says if you share the fact that you've been hacked, you know, you can have some liability protection, so there's an incentive to do it. You don't have to worry as much about, say, antitrust concerns if you're sharing information that might be competitive. There will be a way to share information that you're not, you know, giving your competitors inside information that they can use against you, et cetera. You know, that, because of privacy concerns and some other things, that hasn't passed so far. The White House will make a big push, as Congress will, to get something like that passed this Congress. That would be a big move. A lot of people in industry say, you know, it would be very good for us to share more information with each other and with government. On the other side, government isn't sharing enough information with us because they classify things they don't know need to classify. You know, a lot of times they'll know things that they don't share with us. They're concerned about giving up sources and methods and all of that intelligence stuff. So something needs to address that as well, too.
Right, right. We're talking this hour on All Sides with Ann Fisher about cybersecurity. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. Joseph, the president has other cybersecurity proposals as well. There's one, the Personal Data Notification and Protection Act. What does that propose to do?
Essentially, it aims to have a standardized rules for when you are notified and how soon you're notified if your personal data is breached in the hands of a company. Again, you know, this is meant to be a legislative proposal. There's a question about whether it's going to get out this Congress, and it's tough to get much of anything passed this Congress. But it would formalize the notifications when, you know, your personal information has been compromised, sort of as it was in, you know, Target, Home Depot, places like that.
Right. I think Anthem was recently lambasted mm-hmm. because of their lack of communication with its customers when it was breached recently as well. What are privacy advocates saying about this 30-day requirement that's in this proposal for the personal data notification period?
In general, they're in favor of it. The concern with privacy advocates, the concern that privacy advocates have has much more to do with integrating information on the back end, so that, you know, a lot of your personal information, what they're concerned about is your personal information that's held by a company, you've given to a company, being shared with the government and shared with other companies, you know, in an effort to make cyber defenses stronger. So 30-day notification is great. You should have more control over your own information. You should have more visibility into how your own information has been breached.
Can you talk also a little bit about this? This is another proposal the president has set forth, the Student Digital Privacy Act. The White House press release said it's inspired by a California law. What do we know about it? Do we know much at all about it?
We don't know much at all about it, and I don't know much about the California law. A lot of this goes back to, there was a report that the White House put out earlier this year from its President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and it was sort of independently led by advisor John Podesta, that looked at big data and how data is being used in the marketplace. And what it by and large came up with is, its conclusion was that, you know, we shouldn't stop. Basically, the cat is out of the bag when it comes to collecting personal data. Data is going to be collected all over the place, but we should be looking at either through regulation, through legislation, or through voluntary things done by companies and organizations, is how that data is used. And so there's been a lot of concern about data that's collected by these apps and organizations that track student progress, that, you know, help you communicate with your teacher about homework and things like that. That information ends up getting sold on a secondary market, so people know things about you as a consumer. So I think the general idea of it is that, you know, there are certain places where collecting the data is fine, it's good, it's a service, it helps you become, you know, a better student, more productive, et cetera, but that information shouldn't be used on a secondary market. It's about how it's used, not exactly about how it's collected.
I'm curious, I'm switching gears a little bit here, but we were talking earlier about the government and the private sector sharing and working more with each other. Has there been any talk about accountability on the level of the private sector when these breaches take effect and perhaps they haven't done enough to ensure that the data is secure? Is that being talked about at all?
Accountability is really tough in cybersecurity because, you know, on one level, companies are beginning to feel accountable because they're held accountable in the public sphere. You know, the Target CEO resigned or lost his job after that breach. There have been other situations sort of like that. These companies tend to be kind of pilloried in the public eye, especially when it's clear that they didn't have the kind of cyber defenses they ought to have had. With the most recent Sony hack, Sony claims that, you know, this really isn't going to affect our bottom line by and large. Other places disagree, but certainly, you know, no one wants the kind of press that Sony's had over the last several months. On the one hand, the other hand, when it comes to actually holding companies accountable, a lot of consumers, it's not really top of mind for them. You know, they figure it's sort of a lost cause on the one hand. On the other hand, unless you go through a really terrible identity theft case, which a lot of times this doesn't reach that point because of the information the hackers are actually getting. Usually what it is you've got to go through the trouble of getting a new Target card or getting a new Home Depot card. It's a little bit of bureaucracy for a little while. Maybe there are a few false charges on your account.
Monitoring,
but you go
your credit.
Bank account.
Yeah.
Yeah, you monitor your credit, you go to your bank account, the bank account makes you whole. Consumers aren't really losing money by and large, so they aren't really all that concerned. They tend to not hold companies responsible in the same way. So figuring out how to get the incentives and the accountability right is going to be a tough problem.
All right, Joseph Marks, a reporter for cybersecurity at Politico Pro. Thanks so much for the information and insight today.
Thank you.
Thanks. And we'll be back to talk more about cybersecurity here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mandy Trimble. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble sitting in for Ann today. This hour is about cybersecurity, but first, I want to mention the big story of the day. Today in Columbus, the city was not chosen as the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Democrats selected Philadelphia for the site. Brooklyn, New York was also a finalist. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who heads up the DNC, was in Columbus just a week or so ago for the final visit, which focused on logistics. The city pushed hard about its walkability, its central location with the convention center and the arena, but ultimately Philadelphia was selected. Wasserman Schultz said in an email today that Philadelphia's commitment to a seamless and safe convention was at the heart of part of the decision. The city's deep-rooted place in American history provides a perfect setting for the gathering. The DNC convention will be held the week of July 25th. And we will now move on to cybersecurity. Last week, health insurance giant Anthem revealed personal information of as many as 80 million customers was stolen by hackers. This news came just days before President Obama announced the creation of a new agency to analyze and counter cyber threats. It's called the Cyber Threat Intelligence Integration Center. Joining us now in the studio is Ohio State University law professor Dakota Rudisill. He previously served in the office of the Director of National Intelligence and directs the Ohio State National Security Crisis Simulation. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
And also by phone, joining us by phone, is the Assistant Director of the Center for Cybersecurity at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Richard Forno. Richard, thanks for the time today.
No problem.
You work, Richard, in the Center for Cybersecurity, which spans government, military, and private sector, including helping build a formal cybersecurity program for the U.S. House of Representatives. Richard, after so many high-profile hacks in recent years, there's Target, there's Home Depot, J.P. Morgan Chase. Why didn't Anthem have its customers' data better protected?
I think that's a perennial problem in the cybersecurity industry, is just the protection of the volumes of personal data that is that's available. There's always that trade-off between security and securing the data and information, and having ease of access to that data for legitimate business or personal purposes. It's just the latest in a series of disturbing trends about the need to protect this type of information, both from external and internal compromises.
I talked a little bit about, at the end of the last segment, about accountability. I want to ask you, Dakota, are companies being held accountable for how they secure their data? The last gentleman I had on the show said that's kind of hard to do. Is it illegal? Issue? Why the lack of accountability?
Well, it's a combination of things. The law is part of it, but also economics are part of it. On the economic side, frankly, doing really effective cybersecurity is really, really hard. And that's because just the nature of the internet is that it's vastly easier to attack than it is to defend. And so the result of that is that what companies will do is they will essentially tolerate a certain amount of risk with regard to penetration of their systems. Mm-hmm. And that's frankly what the U.S. government does, and frankly individuals do with their own computers, right? I mean, you could go out and you could buy every sort of, you know, antivirus and other cyber defense mechanism you can commercially find, and you're going to spend a huge amount of money. But most of us are going to say, okay, we're going to take some basic cyber hygiene steps and maybe buy, you know, antivirus, and we're going to stop there. And companies kind of do a similar thing. On the legal side, there are laws both at the federal level and the state level about protecting the private information of subscribers and clients and customers. And so companies are obligated to do that. And when they do a poor job of it, sometimes they, depending on the exact nature of it, they can be vulnerable to suit. So that's kind of one enforcement mechanism. But from the standpoint of the U.S. government in enhancing cooperation between the private sector and the U.S. government on cybersecurity, from the standpoint of the government, it's been a maddening experience. And I think, frankly, from the standpoint of the private sector as well, it's also been a maddening experience.
Richard, what do you think about implementing some accountability to improve security? Is it just enough that, say, Target takes a hit from consumer trust, or do we need more? What are your thoughts?
Well, there's the emotional response that when something bad happens, you want to see accountability. And then there's the practicality of accountability. On one hand, certainly you want to see a CIO or a CEO, you know, held accountable for problems that occur on their watch. But then the reality of the situation is, given the nature of IT and the internet and all these interconnected systems and how we use them, You know, problems like this are quite likely to occur, and it's almost like a fact of life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, would you hold somebody accountable for a traffic jam on your commute to work one day? Part of me hates to say it, but it happens.
Dakota, the president, as I mentioned, is creating a new agency to handle these types of hacks. How would the Cyber Threat Intelligence Integration Center work in a case like the one we saw with Anthem?
So we'll have to see. And one of the key questions is the relationship between this new center, which is going to be located in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, its relationship with private sector actors and its relationship with other actors in the federal government. So I mentioned the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI. ODNI was created after the 9/11 attacks in response to the 9/11 Commission, which looked into the 9/11 attacks and determined that all of the information necessary to detect the plot on 9/11 and disrupt it was actually in the U.S. government.
It was CIA, there, just wasn't being shared.
That's right. The dots, so to speak, were not being collected. Mm-hmm. CIA had some, immigration had some, FBI had some, State Department had some, but nobody put the full picture together. Mm-hmm. And so the point of ODNI is to do intelligence integration. And so ODNI has within it a number of agencies, and these are actually most of what ODNI is. And so there's NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center. There's the NCPC, the National Counterproliferation Center, about weapons of mass destruction. There's another one of these centers on counterintelligence, which is spy versus spy. And so now we're going to have a new one, which is going to be focused on cyber. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's modeled after the National Counterterrorism Center, which is what the White House is saying, and we haven't seen the details on it yet, so we just have, you know, what Lisa Monaco from the White House said and some other things. If it's modeled after the National Counterterrorism Center, what's going to be doing is basically about three basic things. Number one, they're going to be reaching out to other parts of the U.S. government that have information with regard to cyber, pulling that information together. Second, they're going to be doing a unified assessment of all that information about a cyber threat, mm-hmm. and then sharing that with the U.S., with the other agencies in the U.S. government. And then they're going to also be doing something which is called SOP, Strategic Operational Planning. And what that means is planning in a big picture about the U.S. government's response to cyber, but not actually carrying out any sort of response to it. It's just a kind of a high-level planning role, and then leaves to the other agencies, FBI, Homeland Security, CIA, NSA, whoever, they would actually then respond in some sort of capacity to whatever the cyber attack might be. But one of the outstanding issues is this one, just to come back to this, is mm-hmm. what is the relationship going to be between a private sector actor such as Anthem, right, and the U.S. government after this new center is going to be created? And that's not entirely clear yet.
You mentioned all of these other centers. How will the new one, I guess, kind of fit in with the larger law enforcement and intelligence framework? You kind of touched on that. Is that going to be hard to maneuver and navigate?
It's always hard to maneuver and navigate. I served at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and I had kind of a front row seat for seeing the mm-hmm. intel people, the intel agencies, the NSA, the CIA, those folks, talking and interfacing with the law enforcement community at FBI, at the Justice Department. And there's just historically, there's just been a lot of distrust and a lot of inability to communicate between those communities. Now, some of that's just kind of institutional esprit de corps, where each of them thinks, look, we've got the best agency.
Right.
Part of it, though, too, is the mission focus historically, not to oversimplify, but for the intelligence community, has been prospective. We want to figure out what the next bad thing is coming down the pipe mm-hmm. and get the information to the decision makers in time to head that off. In contrast, because the FBI, as a federal criminal investigative entity, is part of the Department of Justice, which is about enforcing the law, they tend to have a retrospective perspective, which is we need to find out when you know, bad thing X happened, we need to find out what were the facts at that time. So they do investigations, provide information to the prosecutors at the Justice Department, and then they go and prosecute somebody for a crime. Now, FBI's gotten a lot more prospective. They want to prevent crime and deter crime. But a lot of the conversations that you hear between the intel people mm-hmm. and the law enforcement people come down to that issue.
Okay. Richard, I was shocked to read that some of the same concerns from the 90s regarding cybersecurity still exist 20 or so years later. I said out loud, how is that even possible? Can you answer that? How is that possible?
Sure. The problems, many of these problems are still with us because the pace of how quickly we've adapted and adopted these technologies, you know, the internet generally, has allowed us to kind of look for the next best thing and look at the conveniences of the what they call the digital world, and risk and resiliency and the possible consequences have been somewhat marginalized as we keep looking for the conveniences and the benefits of these new technologies. Now, that being said, the solutions that have been proposed to deal with these problems also date back to the mid to late 90s. This new integration center that we're talking about, when I first heard that, I flashed back to 1998 when an organization called the National Infrastructure Protection Center was formed within the FBI to do very much a lot of what we're talking about here with this new center. We have the White House Coordinator for Cybersecurity in the early 2000s was charged with government-wide coordination of cyber activities, some of which Dakota mentioned, I think, probably would be this SOP process that they're talking about now. Mm-hmm. So we have a similar set of problems that have remained with us for the past 15, 20 years, and I think in many ways a lot of the same recommendations are with us as well, and we're still in the same situation.
So will this Intelligence Integration Center for cyber threat, is that going to address some of these issues then?
Honestly, as I've read what little has come out thus far, I've been somewhat skeptical. I mean, I'm always holding out hope that this time will be the time when it actually works. But as Dakota said, there are cultural issues we have to deal with as a community. The private sector may not want to play well with law enforcement or the intelligence community and vice versa. There are issues of classified information, how much can you share, and with who and when. So I'm always hopeful, but I'm not exactly optimistic that this will be anything more than another information sharing solution to address this problem, but not really fix it.
How well do you think that's going to work, Dakota?
Well, I guess I'm a little bit more optimistic about it. You know, certainly, you know, having served in government, I've served in all three branches of government, and I've seen government work well and not work well. So, you know, I go into it with that perspective. But I would say overall, you know, look, if this new cyber entity is going to be modeled on the National Counterterrorism Center and these other centers, I think we have some reason to be optimistic that things will get better as a result of it. That the agencies are going to be able to talk to each other better as a cultural matter. They're going to get more used to coming together and talking mm-hmm. about cyber stuff, just like they do. They've gotten more used to talking to each other on counterterrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also an information technology element to this, which the National Counterterrorism Center and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence have really pioneered, which is just literally getting the classified computer networks at different agencies to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And on you know, and in the 90s, and then when 9/11 happened, it was just not the case. It's still a clunky process, but it is now dramatically easier to, despite classification, to share information between those agencies. And especially when you're talking about cyber, where you've got, you know, this is a cyber attack. Information is and attacks are moving in real time. You know, I think facilitating that process is probably a good thing.
One thing I did want to ask about is the line between a cyber crime and mm-hmm. an act of cyber war.
Yeah.
Dakota, what is the difference there?
Well, it is a very blurry line, to be sure. And this just really gets at one of the most difficult issues, which is figuring out the nature of what this attack is that's coming in. So there are a couple different boxes that you could put a cyber attack in. One would be cyber crime. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you could put virtually all cyber attacks right into the crime box. And that is because under the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, any unauthorized tampering with a computer network is a federal crime. So you've got no question about that. And so
Right. If
you know, look into the nature of this, it's an unauthorized tampering. You're able to go through the process of identifying your attacker. You know, you can almost always build a prosecution case. Now, the question is, when does some sort of cyber attack get big enough that we say this is an act of war? And we don't have a fully fleshed out answer on that, but we're starting to get more of one. And it seems it sounds like there's consensus at the very least that if a cyber attack causes a level of damage in the real world, which is tantamount to what you'd get from an armed attack, mm-hmm. right? That's an act of war. And then that puts us in a different mindset from kind of the type of response that we want to have and then the type of legal authorities that can be invoked.
What would be, I guess, an example of cyber war?
Cyber war. Well, so the one which gets really kind of the, you know, probably the most discussion as kind of a cyber Pearl Harbor, a cyber 9/11 would be some sort of attack which takes down in large part or in full the power grid within the United States, which would cause obviously immense inconvenience, immense economic damage, immense suffering. A lot of people would die. And so, you know, something like that. Which, you know, and you hear various accounts and, you know, in the public discussion of this, but, you know, there's some assertions that there are some foreign state actors which potentially might have the power to take down part of the power grid. You know, if they were to do that, I think that without question, the United States government would regard that as an act of war. Now, the question then is what sort of response? Do you have a cyber response to an act of cyber war, or do you potentially have, you know, some other type of national security response to that?
Has there been any discussion on the type of response yet?
Quite a bit of discussion. Quite a bit of discussion. And basically where U.S. government policy is right now is that if a cyber attack is severe enough to be regarded as an act of war, the United States would not necessarily limit its response to being a cyber response.
Okay, so perhaps boots on the ground? I mean, we just...
boots on the ground.
Nothing's necessarily off the table then.
That's right. I mean, okay. So again, not a lot has been fleshed out here, but when you read the public statements carefully, when you read the federal documents carefully that are, you know, that are out there, you know, that kind of emerges, that the government doesn't want to bind itself. Now, having said that, in the Sony hack case that arose late last year in relation to this movie, The Interview, mm-hmm. Where the federal government said, we're pretty confident this is North Korea. And, you know, you can say, well, was that an act of cyber vandalism, as the president said, or an act of war?
Right.
But based on what was in the public discussion on this, a lot of North Korea's internet capability was interrupted. And so what we see there is a cyber attack by a state actor and arguably, and I honestly don't know, nobody's briefed me, but if the United States did respond against North Korea's internet capability, then we had a cyber response to a cyber attack.
Very good. We're going to take a quick break. We'll return to All Sides with Ann Fisher in just a moment. I'm Mandy Trimble, where we will have the discussion, more discussion rather, on cybersecurity. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble sitting in for Ann. Today, this hour is about cybersecurity. But first, if you're just joining us, the big news of the day today is that Columbus was not chosen to be the site of the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Instead, Democrats chose Philly to host the event. Brooklyn, New York was the third finalist. The DNC chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, visited Columbus just about a week ago for the final visit to kind of focus on logistics. That's when city leaders really pushed Columbus's close proximity of the convention center and nationwide arena with major hotels downtown. But ultimately, Democrats did choose Philly. Debbie Wasserman Schultz said in an email today that in addition to Philadelphia's commitment to a seamless and safe convention, the city's deep-rooted place in American history is the perfect setting for this special event. Philly, it's interesting to note, has hosted about 8 party conventions. The 2016 convention will be held the week of July 25th. This hour, we are discussing cybersecurity threats and the policies in place to address them. Still with us is Ohio State University law professor Dakota Rudisill, and with us by phone is the assistant director of the Center for Cybersecurity at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Richard Forno. Welcome back to the show. Many of the attacks that have made news in recent years have been connected to other nations. How are those cyber attacks classified? Dakota, can you address that?
cyber attacks by other nation states?
Yes.
Well, so there are a couple. So we kind of referenced earlier, you could put cyber attacks into a couple boxes. One is a cyber attack is a criminal act. Another is that it's an act of war. A couple other boxes, which potentially get even more use when we're talking about a state actor. Another is maybe the cyber attack is espionage. Spy activity. And so here we've seen, again, discussed in the public record that allegedly the People's Republic of China infiltrated Defense Department computers and downloaded the plans for the F-35 fighter. So that looks like, you know, stealing military plans as kind of old school spycraft is just done over a computer network, right?
Can we ever really know where these attacks come from? You know, Forbes recently was hacked, and investigators think it was a group in China, but they don't know. Richard, is there ever really a way to know where these come from, and how do they find out?
Well, that's one of the biggest issues we as a community have to overcome, is the question of attribution of these attacks, because on the internet, a foreign nation could attack another nation, but go through several intermediaries, so that the victim, in trying to see who's attacking them, will only see the last hop, if you will, between, you know, in this chain. So there's a lot of room for error in attribution or misattribution, which ties back into what Dakota was talking about earlier about what kind of responses can be done and when. You don't want to respond against the wrong country.
Right.
So attribution of the attacker on one level technically is very doable, but you need to make sure that it actually is the attacker and not an innocent victim, an intermediary that just was hacked themselves to make it look like they were the attackers. It's a very complicated situation.
We were talking just a moment ago, very briefly at the end of the segment, about power grids being hacked. In Dakota, you were saying that could be considered a cyber war. New York's power grid system was hacked. And Richard, you wrote that the solution to that problem is simply to remove the systems from the public internet. First, I guess either one of you, Dakota or Richard, could answer just how vulnerable are those systems, and how well prepared are we when it comes to those kinds of attacks that could affect millions and millions of people? Dakota?
Well,
or Richard?
I think
Richard?
Sure, I'll jump in.
Okay.
The question I have is, if something is deemed a critical infrastructure, a power generator plant or a water purification treatment plant, why is that on a publicly reachable network? If you remove the interface between that facility and the public network, the internet, the phone system, whatever, you're making it more difficult for a bad guy, domestically or internationally, to cause electronic damage against it. But as we said at the top of the show, there's this trade-off between security and convenience in these networks, and it's easier to network them together and monitor them from a central location. It saves on manpower, staffing, and resources than to, you know, throw some more money to have separate networks. So that's a great example of the trade-off between security and convenience for a critical system.
Dakota, are cities moving more toward taking their systems like the power grid off of the public internet? Do you have any idea?
So that's not a question that I've looked at myself, so I couldn't address that. But one thing that I would, that I would address about this idea of basically taking the power grid off the internet,
right,
you may well see some increase in security with the costs that were mentioned. But it's important to understand that is, you know, certainly not a full answer. A perfect example of this is the Stuxnet attack on Iran's nuclear program, which was discussed on in a prior edition of this show back in December. Kim Zetter and I were on talking about it. And again, just what happened in Stuxnet is evidently the U.S. intelligence services and the Israeli intelligence services collaborated on writing a computer virus that, when inserted into the Iranian nuclear weapons program, caused a large number of their centrifuges, which create highly enriched uranium, to spin out of control and destroy themselves, and thereby set back the nuclear weapons program. Of course, Iran's centrifuges were not on the internet. There was what's called an air gap between those systems and the internet. So the solution that the U.S. and the Israeli spy services evidently came up with was to get this on a thumb drive. Which then somebody then did insert into the system, and the virus moved that way. So if you just think how often you might plug something into your computer,
right?
Or somebody might do that at a nuclear power plant or a coal plant in this country. It's not
taken down that simply.
That's right,
Richard. From a technical standpoint, is there any foolproof cybersecurity system?
Yes, it's one that's unplugged from the internet and turned off. absent those conditions, I think you've always got some level of vulnerability and exposure to risk, and we have to just be prepared to deal with them the best we can.
Is the major hurdle, though, technical, or is it human?
I think it's human. If you think about it, humans are responsible for using the computers and the networks, designing the products and services and networks. We're involved in every aspect of this environment. And, it's us that decide to write down our passwords. It's us that decide to use questionable, products and services. So in a lot of ways, many of the problems that we encounter and see may well be self-inflicted because of how we've decided to use these technologies.
What needs to be done? We have this, or we're going to have this new center for cybersecurity. What would be their role in educating the public on what they can do in large to help prevent something like this? Dakota, has there been any discussion about that?
So I haven't heard specifically about this new entity within the Office of the Director of National Intelligence doing that. I would suspect that they're going to be doing some of that public diplomacy. Mm-hmm. But frankly, I think that most of that is going to be, frankly, done probably through DHS and this entity at DHS, which is the acronym is the NCIC, the National Cyber and Communications Information Center. DHS's mission is, much more internally focused than is the U.S. intelligence community, and so DHS is going to be working with the private sector and average people to improve what's called just cyber hygiene, right? Mm-hmm. Just like which sites you visit, buying, keeping your antivirus current, being mindful about what you're plugging into your computer, that sort of thing.
Richard, you said yes. What info do you have on the public's role and how the public, I guess, sector may be, like you said, DHS may be helping the public learn what we can do to, make this more secure?
Sure. Well, Dakota's right. DHS has taken the lead on these types of initiatives and outreach, but you also have groups in the National Institutes of Standard and Technology in the Commerce Department. They have an initiative on cybersecurity education from kindergarten all the way up through college and postgraduate to help teachers at various levels teach their students, these cyber hygiene practices, as well as more of the esoteric things if they want to pursue this as a career. You've got nonprofits like the National Cyber Security Alliance, Stay Safe Online, that also do these types of outreach at conferences and in communities around the country to, again, get grassroots folks interested and knowledgeable on the basics of cybersecurity.
I wonder how much we touched on it very slightly about cost. How much cost is a factor in the lack of changes to cybersecurity? Dakota, what are your thoughts on that? Is that what is stopping a lot of upgrades to infrastructure?
Certainly. It's very, very costly. There's a constant arms race going on every second between basically the cyber bad actors out there and, everybody from individuals to companies to the government that want to protect their systems. And again, it is far easier to attack than it is to defend on the internet due to its extent, its complexity, and then the preference of open societies for networking absolutely everything, mm-hmm. including the new thing that we're starting to hear about, which is this idea of the Internet of Things, that your washer and dryer are going to be on the internet. And, many people already, through their iPhone apps, if you've been away on vacation, turn your lights on and turn on the heat an hour mm-hmm. before you get home to warm up your house. Well, the more stuff you stick on the internet, the more stuff that could get hacked.
Richard, what do you think about investing in the short term? It may be costly, but in the long run, wouldn't it pay off?
I think it will pay off. Again, if you invest in the correct things and you make sure these initiatives and products are kept current, these types of improvements will help raise the bar, but they won't make the problem go away completely. And that's what we have to understand here. There will always be risks to our information and networks, no matter what we do. It's just, how do we manage them? How do we prepare for them? And how do we mitigate them when bad things do occur?
Dakota, you mentioned something about personal items just now. You're talking about the washer and dryer and the lights, and you can even remotely turn your car on. I was watching the news the other night and saw a spot about cyber ransom. And could this seems to be something new? Have both of you guys heard about this?
Yeah.
Where somebody gets onto your computer and threatens to encrypt everything, and you have to pay hundreds of dollars or lose your stuff.
So this is a growing phenomenon, and we've been seeing it at the personal level, as you mentioned. We've been seeing it at the corporate level, and one of the great concerns is that this could potentially even happen at, you know, the state-to-state level, where one state or its proxies hacks into another state, you know, something about just another country, and, you know, says, you know, we're going to, you know, destroy this information, we're going to compromise it, we're going to do X, Y, or Z, you know, unless you do whatever it is we want you to do. So it's a major concern.
The experts, and I can't recall who they were on the show, but they were saying don't pay it. And if you don't pay the ransom, there would be no reason to have these cyber security ransom anyway. But I guess for groups like police departments who have investigation files, like where does the ethics play into this? Richard, do you have any thoughts on that as far as what folks are supposed to do, you know, particularly when it gets to the level of, say, a police department or doctor's offices who have all of these files? Do you pay or do you lose?
Well, some people certainly pay, obviously, or they wouldn't. We wouldn't still see this as a type of an attack. I think one good practice is ensuring that you maintain regular backups of your information, whether you're a business or at home. The idea being that, again, it raises the bar. If suddenly you're working on your computer and you see a message saying, I've got your data, you know, give me $1,000 or else, you hopefully will be able to go to your backup drive and recover your data and then take steps to rebuild your computer. So it's not exactly a painless process, but it's one possible solution to help, again, make it more difficult for this attack to really cause you problems.
As the government begins to take cybersecurity to the next level, some critics are concerned that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act might be used overzealously against regular users and restrain security research. What about that, Dakota? Do you think it could cross that line?
So this is something that the White House is trying to respond to, and there are some voices in Congress who are saying that this needs to be addressed as well. And really what it comes back to is the expansive way that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is written, which, you know, basically any sort of unauthorized use, tampering, accessing, modification of a computer network can come within the ambit of the federal criminal penalties. Now, what that means right now as a practical matter is a lot of prosecutorial and investigative discretion for the Justice Department and the FBI. And so a response to this concern is, you know, if you talk to people at FBI or DOJ, they'd probably tell you, you know, look, you know, if somebody is tampering with a computer in some sort of kind of white hat hack effort to kind of try to identify vulnerabilities and then fix them, you know, we're probably not going to go after that stuff. We have limited resources, limited people, so it's not that big of a problem. But naturally, law enforcement agencies always want as much authority as they can get. So when they do find what they believe really is a bad actor, they can go after them.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Dakota Rudisill, assistant professor at the Moritz College of Law, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Richard Forno, thanks so much for your expertise today.
Thank
you. I'm Mandy Trimble. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.